From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Hello and welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Kim Lewis, and joining me on the panel this week are VOA Senior Diplomatic Correspondent Cindy Sain and Washington Correspondent for Project 10 TV Australia, Michael Williams. Welcome, Cindy and Michael.
Thank you, Kim.
Thank you, Kim.
Well, here are the issues. Democratic and Republican leaders on Capitol Hill are starting to temper expectations among their members about what a final debt ceiling deal could look like, becoming more explicit in acknowledging that neither side will get everything as the June 1st deadline approaches. The Republican Party primary field is growing bigger. Senator Tim Scott, a Republican of South Carolina, made his candidacy official on Monday. Scott's run is historic in that he is the first Black office holder to seek the Republican presidential nomination. And Florida Governor Ron DeSantis suffered a chaotic start to his presidential election race when glitches marred an online forum hosted by Elon Musk that was meant to showcase DeSantis' fitness for the job. Ukraine's Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba toured African countries this week, stepping up Kyiv's diplomatic push to challenge Russian influence on the continent and cement the vision laid out by Ukraine as the only path to peace. Here in the U.S., a criminal investigation in Uvalde, Texas, over the hesitant police response to the Robb Elementary School shooting is still ongoing, as May 24th marked 1 year since a gunman killed 19 children and two teachers inside a fourth-grade classroom. President Biden called on Republicans in Congress to act to end the epidemic of gun violence in the United States in a speech marking the school shooting. Well, those are the issues, and let's get started. Well, the United States could run out of money to pay its debts as soon as June 1st, and it appears both Democrats and Republicans are realizing neither side will get everything they want. Why has this issue become so contentious this year, Cindy?
Well, Kim, that's a good question. And the first thing that I always like to point out is this is about money that the U.S. government has already spent. And this is something that I think gets lost a lot of the time. I mean, I think the time and the place people can have differences about, you know, what priorities, what the government should spend its money on and what maybe perhaps programs, defense programs or social programs or what should be cut. But this is debt that the U.S. has already spent. So this is basically just paying your bills. And I think that's something that needs to be realized. And we had Democratic Representative Adam Schiff saying, let's don't overcomplicate this. Under former President Trump, Republicans passed a $2 trillion tax cut bill, and now they don't want to pay for it. And I think that there is some truth to that. I mean, Republicans, Democrats, whoever were in office, this is money that they decided to spend. So it is a very contentious issue as we're speaking right now. It's still at an impasse, and it looks like House Republicans are going to leave for a U.S. Memorial Day holiday. And we're waiting to see if there's some face-saving way that an agreement can be reached, with the White House saying, look, this our members of Congress' job is to raise the debt ceiling so that the U.S. government does not, for the first time ever, default on its debt. And then we have, of course, Republican House Speaker Kevin McCarthy trying to win concessions, trying to get certain requirements for welfare that people would have to work for to get compensation and that sort of thing. So we are in kind of a mess here, with some saying that a U.S. credit rating is already at risk of downgrading.
Yeah, I think you make some very good points there. And really, the key thing about it is that this is the money that's already been spent. That's such a relevant thing to say, because this is a result of politicians trying to negotiate the budget through debt ceiling talks. Congress can't get together on a budget and pass a budget. And so you govern by continuing resolution, which automatically raises costs. And then you start to bicker over the costs and the money that you've already spent. It's kind of a childish cyclical argument, but it happens every so often. There's this thing about the House Republicans and their conservative caucus wanting to cut costs going forward. They're having that as part of the negotiations, while the White House position is that, okay, we'll freeze spending in upcoming budgets. And there's a difference in that. And then there's the idea if you want to cut. I think the Republicans are saying 8%. Well, where do you cut, especially if military spending is off the table? It's very difficult to do that. Everyone says, well, let's cut this number, that number, but they don't really get specific on what exactly it is that they want to cut without being very, very unpopular with each and every one of their constituents. There's a lot of posturing and positioning that's going on, and I think governing about a budget in exactly the wrong place and in the wrong room. And by the way, whatever does happen in the room still has to be passed by the Congress. So you have to get votes. So there's this whole idea of not only putting together something in the room that pleases the people that are sitting in the room, but actually threading the needle of both the Progressive Caucus on the Democratic side and the Conservative Caucus on the Republican side and getting those people to agree to it. I think eventually we will get to a deal because there's too much at stake if it doesn't. And scholars even say that it's unconstitutional for the United States to default. The 14th Amendment says that the faith and credit of the United States government shall not be put into question. So I would think if you default on your debt, that's a big fat question. In the case that it would happen, there would be so many financial breaker switches that would go off and cause a crisis in the country that nobody wants, that I think reasonable minds will prevail and we'll get to a deal. But as Cindy has said, it's probably needlessly complicated and fraught just because of the personalities and the politics that are involved.
Yes, and also, as you mentioned, Congress still has to vote on it. So any deal that House Speaker Kevin McCarthy makes will have to win support from a large majority of the House Republicans in order for him to keep the confidence of his conference and possibly his gavel. So is there a possibility that his position is at risk?
I would say yes. Probably on a daily basis, to some extent, his gavel is in danger because we all remember that whole drama and theater that was around his election and the amount of deals that he had to make to get that position. And some of the details we still don't know, but we can assume that part of them were around this particular negotiation and how it would be handled, him getting the votes, the folks who eventually put him into this office. And it's interesting that you use the word confidence, because I think while he got the votes of a number of people, I don't think he has the confidence of very many people in that caucus. There's a significant number of people who don't have confidence in him, despite him having the gavel. So whether or not he just loses it for him, I think it certainly put him on even shakier ground and put him in a position for a challenge.
Yes, I would agree with that exactly. And I covered Congress for many years and walked those halls in 2011, the last time we had this scare of the U.S. defaulting. And I think that Speaker McCarthy is in a much shakier position than then Speaker John Boehner was, even though, you know, it was like herding cats for him as well. I would agree with Michael that it's kind of he walks a tightrope on a daily basis.
Well, the Republican Party primary field is getting larger. Senator Tim Scott, a Republican of South Carolina, made his candidacy official this week. The sole Black Republican in the Senate, he does have support within his party and has raised a substantial sum of campaign money. But how will he hold up against present frontrunner Donald Trump?
We have Tim Scott and we have DeSantis, and we'll talk a little bit about DeSantis in a minute. I assume in both of those launches were kind of defined by their technical glitches and inherent metaphors in that technical failure and how their campaigns are now and could end up. But Tim Scott, there's this narrative that he grew up in the South as a Black man, overcame whatever obstacles that are there for him because of race, because of his financial position, all of those things. And it's a great story. And in other years, in other campaigns, I think it would have made him a very viable and reasonable candidate for a middle ground of the Republican Party. But two things are there. Number one, that middle ground largely does not exist anymore. So he's speaking to a very, very small audience when he's talking about that. Number two, it's that idea that racism, because he's able to overcome it, that it doesn't really exist. And everybody else has the same circumstances and same abilities. It's a very existential and I think maybe selfish way to look at things. You have Tim Scott and DeSantis, again, we'll talk about, and Nikki Haley. You have all these main Republican candidates who are there. And what they have in common is their arguments about the culture wars and fighting woke culture and the broad disapproval of the Biden administration and border crisis, and their issues are almost exactly the same. But what none of them do, one, is they talk about Trump losing for the party, but they're not willing to admit, not one of them, that he actually lost his election. So they're saying he's a loser, but they won't say that he lost. And the other thing is that they seem not to be able to go after him in particular and say to a Trump voter why that Trump voter should vote for anybody other than Trump. And until they can effectively make a case for that, I think they're essentially running for vice president on his ticket. They're all trying to bypass the primary and essentially run against Biden in a general election. But that's not the way it works. You have to win the primary. And while Trump has suffered a ton of disappointing defeats for the Republican Party, he remains undefeated in Republican primaries. So I wonder how that actually works out for any of these candidates. I can't see a path to success for them currently.
A lot of fantastic points there. And I think that with Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina, he, to my mind, is more of a traditional Republican, faith-based. He's pro-business. And as Michael just pointed out, that is our father's Republican Party and not the Republican Party of today, it would seem. And with his sort of more polite, traditional Republican message, I'm not sure if that's going to really galvanize the majority of Republican voters. And I would agree with Michael, although I'm sure Senator Scott would probably not agree, that it looks perhaps maybe he is hoping to be on former President Trump's ticket as the vice president. Interestingly, Trump has been attacking DeSantis on a daily basis on social media, and he just wished Senator Scott well. So that kind of caught my attention.
Yeah, very interesting. And also, you've mentioned Michael, Ron DeSantis, and I was listening to some analysts who said they were expecting him to just come out against Donald Trump. He did not do that. I don't know if this was a particular strategy he was using or he just did not want to do it.
It's a lack of strategy. The notable thing about that DeSantis campaign is that, as far as I know, there isn't any real political heavy hitter running that campaign. It's done by a bunch of people who've never done it before. And you can say anything you want about the American political presidential races, okay? And there's lots that can be said. But one thing that has to be said is that it's hard. It's a really difficult thing to do. And there's a relatively small number of people who know how to do it and do it well. And none of them are working with DeSantis currently.
Right. I would agree, Michael. And, you know, it's sort of on paper, he looks like the perfect candidate for the Republican nomination. He's 44 years old, young and dynamic and very popular, won by a huge margin in Florida and a governor of a big state. But some Florida reporters had said he's not very good at what we call retail politics, mixing and mingling with voters and shaking hands. And then he had this long anticipated announcement where it was on Twitter with a sort of a disembodied voice where he was not with voters. You know, because of technical glitches, it turned out to be an embarrassment. And of course, this is not something that he can't recover from, but it does sort of feed into the narrative that, well, maybe he's not that comfortable with voters. And as Michael said, even though it's a well-funded political operation, maybe it's not quite ready for primetime.
Also, the NAACP issued a formal travel advisory for Florida. NAACP President and CEO Derek Johnson said, quote, under the leadership of Governor DeSantis, the state of Florida has become hostile to Black Americans and in direct conflict with the democratic ideals that our union was founded upon, unquote. So DeSantis calls this a political stunt. Will this pick up any steam or will it just die down?
Well, I am watching this closely, Kim, and it's not just the NAACP. We've had LGBTQ groups calling for boycotts of Florida because of legislation that DeSantis has passed. We have the truckers and the largest Hispanic civil rights groups calling for a boycott of Florida because of recent legislation that DeSantis signed that would impose criminal penalties for anyone transporting an undocumented person across state lines. So if you have truck drivers not wanting to go to Florida, and of course, Michael already mentioned this big war that DeSantis has with probably the biggest employer in Florida, Walt Disney World, it gives sort of red meat to the culture wars and perhaps the base of the Republican Party. But I'm thinking that over time, this could really prove to be an economic liability for the state.
I am always struck by the inherent sort of hypocrisy of some of DeSantis' arguments, because he always talks about freedom of speech and businesses able to do what they want. And yet it seems to be, as is the case with Disney and other companies, business gets to do what you want, except if it's not what we want as well. There's a hypocrisy about it that I think gets exposed over time in some very practical ways. And those practical ways are when you talk about boycotts of companies, truckers, individuals saying enough already.
Good points. Well, it's time now for a quick break. And when we return, we'll look at Kyiv's diplomatic push to challenge Russian influence in the global south. Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/issues. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype, VOA Senior Diplomatic Correspondent Cindy Sain and Washington Correspondent for Project 10 TV Australia, Michael Williams. Well, Russia's top diplomat, Dmytro Kuleba, said the main priority for visiting Africa was to get African countries to endorse President Volodymyr Zelensky's peace plan. And this is part of Ukraine's diplomatic push to challenge Russian influence in the global south, a term meaning Latin America, Africa, and much of Asia. So, Cindy, are these diplomatic efforts in the global south helping to end Russia's war on Ukraine?
Well, not so far, Kim. And it is a big push by Ukraine. And you had Foreign Minister Kuleba telling African leaders and pleading with them, basically saying, look, neutrality in the face of what is going on with Russia committing atrocities against Ukrainian children and civilians is not the answer. And he said, if you project neutrality towards Russian aggression against Ukraine, then you're basically projecting neutrality against violations of borders and mass crimes that might occur close to you sometime soon. Russia has built up significant presence in many parts of Africa. And recently, Russia has held military drills with South Africa. There are some suspicions that South Africa may have provided arms to Russia. And Russia's planning to hold an Africa-Russia summit in July. So Ukraine is trying to sort of reverse fortunes. And what we've seen since the Russia invaded Ukraine is that the U.S. and the West has just poured money and resources into Ukraine, while Russia has poured money into resources into sort of winning the war of hearts and minds in the global south, as you mentioned, Kim. So this is a pushback. We saw Zelensky speaking to Arab leaders and going to the G7 summit in Japan and trying to basically compete with other peace plans that are out there, including by China, and say, look, Ukrainian President Zelensky's peace plan calls for all Russian troops to be out, and this is the peace plan that needs to be the one.
You made really a lot of very key and relevant points there. And so I can just say that it's very interesting and positive and encouraging to see that Africa be sort of the linchpin of this argument, to see Africa be so important, significant in this particular global situation. It's unusual from the American perspective to have Africa be that key. And I think that when you look at the African nations and their interests in this thing, they're really weighing this out very carefully because they have so much Russian presence, as you said, on the continent. They have their own issues like infrastructure projects that are being funded and built and by Russia and by China. It's a really interesting diplomatic balancing act. Yeah, it's interesting that Ukraine is calling for diplomatic support. As far as I know, they're not asking for military support in any way, but just their support. It'll be interesting to see how they are going to display their diplomatic support by not being customers of Russia for certain products and goods and services, by refusing to have other interactions with that country. It's going to be interesting to see how that diplomatic component plays out in this conflict.
Let's get in our last topic. May 24th marked the one-year anniversary of a shooting in Uvalde, Texas, where 19 fourth graders and two teachers were killed when a gunman stormed Robb Elementary School. 17 others were injured. This is still an ongoing investigation on the delayed response of the officers. However, the mass shootings have continued here in the U.S., and President Biden is still looking to push for more gun reform. The big question is, will the president get it?
I am not confident that he will. I see no evidence that this particular event or any event that's going to happen tomorrow or the next day, what would have to change? How many? How brutal? What weapon has to be used in order to get that type of the change, that type of a thing pushed across the finish line? You know, you had the president speaking in front of 21 candidates that represented the 21 lost, I believe 19 children and two teachers. You know, we forget about the trauma of the living. How about the teacher who was shot and survived but lost 11 of his students in that day? How about a father who died 2 days after losing his daughter of what a doctor called it a broken heart from losing his daughter? How about the memories of the town's only pediatrician, one pediatrician in that town who was helpless to save all these children who were cut to ribbons by weapons of war in their school? You know, there's a lot of remorse on that day and every day since and on the anniversary. But until that remorse is converted to resolve, we just wait, tissues at the ready for the next Uvalde.
Like Michael, I'm also just struck by, as a parent, just by the unfathomable fact that there was a 77-minute delay for the police to go in and do something. And just getting my head around, as a parent, very little has happened. Only 4 of the nearly 200 officers who responded from state and local agencies were fired, 4 resigned. And most of the families have this frustration about going to their local grocery store or whatever and seeing then police officers who were there that day and who have not been held accountable. And most of them have shifted their focus to trying to change Texas gun laws, and unfortunately also without much success. And I would agree with Michael that I think President Biden has done what he could with executive orders and everything. And as long as we have Republican majority in the House, I don't see that there's going to be an assault weapon ban or other significant legislation passed.
Well, it's time now to find out what is weighing on the minds of our panelists this week. Cindy, what has been weighing on your mind this week?
Well, we had a rock and roll giant, Tina Turner, pass away. Just amazing singer, dancer, live performer. I think she really is both professionally and personally the ultimate comeback kid, because as many will remember, she was in a duet with Ike Turner, who turned out to be a drug addict and to be abusive to her. He belittled her and beat her, and she divorced him and then kind of went into obscurity. And she said basically that when she left Ike, she had just 36 cents and a gas station credit card to her name, and then only to come back in the 80s and have an amazing career, solo career. May she rest in peace. And personally, she also married a caring younger man, a German man, who even in later years gave her one of her kidneys. So she had quite the personal and professional comeback.
I'll say that what's on my mind is the same thing, Tina Turner. And my thoughts go back to Saturday morning in 1985, living in Washington, D.C., and I woke up to this concert on TV called Live Aid. It's this groundbreaking concert that raised global awareness and relief for the famine in Ethiopia. And I sat watching the two concerts in London and Philadelphia as the biggest performers in the world gave their all on the stage. And they did it for nothing, absolutely nothing, just for charity. And one of the best moments in that whole amazing star-studded thing was a duet with Mick Jagger and the incomparable Tina Turner. And Tina showed everything she was in that moment to the entire world. She was a unique combination of power and grace, who to overcome abuse and adversity to become, her nickname is the Queen of Rock and Roll. And I remember watching her and the other stars and thinking that a society, a world that could make that amazing global relief effort happen was surely on a very, very positive path. While I still believe we are on a positive path, certainly that path is harder to see these days, and it will be even more difficult going forward without the likes of Tina Turner lighting the way.
Well said, both of you. And we will end the show on those notes. My thanks to our panelist, VOA Senior Diplomatic Correspondent Cindy Sain, and Washington Correspondent for Project 10 TV Australia, Michael Williams. I'm Kim Lewis, and be sure to join us next weekend for more Issues in the News.